Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How is India reinventing itself economically, socially, and culturally? A few years before Anand Giridharadas was born near Cleveland, Ohio, his young parents left behind family, friends, and centuries of tradition in India to forge a new life for themselves in the United States. They gave their children a childhood that was both typically American, with Western clothes, snowball fights, and neighborhood block parties, and influenced by Indian heritage, with traditional clothes for holidays and weddings, a tolerance for but never an embrace of U.S. consumer culture, and annual visits to India to see family and friends. As a kid, Giridharadas didn't find much to admire in India, which seemed poorer and less progressive than the country where he'd been raised. But when he moved there to live and work as a young adult, he discovered an amazingly dynamic society, actively evolving a 21st century ethos. Anand Giridharadas writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. His book is called India Calling, an intimate portrait of a nation's remaking. Anand, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
You give us this wonderful portrait here of your parents, who were so open to new American ideas and customs and even popular culture, and yet have never felt it necessary to reject what they love about being Indian. Can you tell us a little bit about them?
You know, they, I think, were very fortunate when they emigrated to this country in the late 1970s to have come to Cleveland, Ohio. My father was in graduate school in Boston for 2 years, and then they moved together as a couple to Cleveland. And when I look back, you can never be sure, but I think if they had moved to New Jersey or New York or California, or a place with a lot of Indians, a lot of other minorities, they might have felt attracted to stay among people like them. But instead, in Cleveland, Ohio, where there weren't that many people like them, where people had no idea who they were or what they were doing there, or why my mother had a red dot in the middle of her head, there was a kind of almost forced integration with the society around them. And they really came to love that society, and I think find in that society a freedom and an openness that almost no other country in the world offers, and certainly not India at that time.
It was your father more than your mother who was eager to move to the U.S. What motivated him to pick up and leave?
He was one of thousands upon thousands of young men who came of age in the 60s and 70s in India, worked very, very hard, were pressured by their parents to study and educate themselves and pull themselves up, and who then found, once they had done that, and thrived and won gold medals as he did and ended up on the job market, that there was nothing in the Indian job market, no jobs, no positions, no opportunities to match all the slogging that he'd done to get there. It was kind of a very disappointing climax. And what he found, he said to me one day that, when he was working at the Tata Group in India, which is this great big conglomerate today, it's one of the great dynamic global conglomerates, and everybody celebrates it. But, 30 years ago, the world was very different. And he said, he looked at his bosses 20 years ahead of him in line and concluded that he didn't want to spend his life becoming them. And so he became one of thousands of people to feel a version of that and to end up in this country.
Take yourself back to your trips to India when you were 8 or 10 or 12 years old. What were your overwhelming impressions of this place?
I think they were very shaped by my being from America. I guess the way I would best describe it is I felt a kind of shrunkenness when I arrived in India. And I felt it was partly going from a kind of small American nuclear household into kind of bigger Indian households where the self, your own self, shrinks. And there's a million people and noise and chaos and interruption and so that's one kind of shrinking. I think there was another and more disappointing kind of shrinking, which was that people in America, this is a kind of almost a cliche, tend to become the fullest possible expressions of themselves. That's one of the things that makes America a great country. And in India, there was so much potential greatness in people, so much wisdom, so much intellect, so much spiritual strength. And yet people didn't seem to have the opportunity to flower and become the fullest possible expressions of themselves. you can start by saying that was true of, you know, essentially all the women, so that's half the population, who were much more silent than the men and compelled into silence. It was also true of young people. You know, my cousins were brilliant. They knew so much more than I did. They memorized all this stuff in school. They knew history. They knew science. They knew math. And yet, when we'd have a discussion as a family around a dinner table with these people, they would really find it difficult to kind of make a point or contradict an adult. And there was the poverty as well. There was the kind of survivalism of the place. But all in all, it just felt to me a place without dreams, a place where people kind of curled up instead of spread out.
So what made you start thinking seriously? I guess in for a lot of first-generation Americans, there is that point in their lives where no matter what they've experienced before, they really want to understand this place where they would have been had their parents not made this extraordinary move. Can you talk about what made you think when you went to work for McKinsey, okay, I want to do this in India?
It's funny. You know, it now seems like this big, ponderous decision, but in a way it was very simple. Instinct and decision at the time. I was a senior in college, and like a lot of seniors in college, you kind of confront this moment of truth and you realize the gravy train is going to end and you've got to kind of go create a sustainable livelihood of your own. And this comes as a shock. And it forces a kind of examination of, okay, now that I can't take six classes and kind of go to parties on the weekend and call that a life, what is the one thing I want to do? And that emerged, I think, as writing over the course of that year of reflection. And it's not easy to figure out how you become a writer if that's your goal. There's no big writing firm in New York where you can show up and become an associate. And so I thought about being a journalist, thought about moving down to the South, I thought about going to Iraq, I mean, I thought about all kinds of different things. And the idea that came to me after a while was good writing comes from some kind of collision with the unfamiliar, and that I should go just live somewhere, not worry about which paper I'm writing for or what I'm writing, but just go live someplace that provokes me. And then once that was the criteria, you know, I thought about Belgium, I thought about the Middle East, but it seemed very obvious that India was this big, extraordinary civilization that was in my blood and that I hadn't dealt with. And I just thought, why not go deal with it?
And you were already at this time fluent in Hindi, is that right?
Not at all. I spoke 6.5 words of Hindi. I learned Hindi, I picked up a little bit more, maybe doubled my 6.5 to 13 when I was at McKinsey. But again, McKinsey is a very westernized environment in India, so you don't need to speak anything else besides English. So I learned Hindi as soon as I got this job, a year and a half into being in India, being with McKinsey, I left and became a foreign correspondent for the Herald Tribune and the Times. And at that point, I bought every book I could about India and sat, you know, reading it to understand the country and studied Hindi.
When you first got to India as an adult, did people know by looking at you right away that you were not Indian born?
It's funny, you know. I still don't quite understand how this works. And all of us first generation Americans of Indian origin who've gone back, we talk about this. That, you know, I mean, To our minds, we look like the people around us, but people can really tell. And Indians often say it's the way we walk. I've still not figured out how we walk that's different from how anybody else walks. But apparently, people say it's in the walk, and then of course clothes and accent is a dead giveaway. But even before accent, you can tell in the prices you're initially charged in the bazaar that people know you're not from around here.
You know, it's interesting when going back to what you had said about this idea that, you know, individual self is a concept that is just now starting to emerge fully for young people in India. I wonder if there was something about, you say walk, but the way you carried yourself and maybe the confidence that you had?
I think that's right. I think probably, you know, many Indians said this to me in the course of my 6 years living in India, that if Indians have one talent more acute than any other people in the world, it's the ability to place people based on relatively small amounts of information. The ability to figure out, is he better than me or am I better than him? Who needs to give who respect? Who is this guy? And Indians do this with relatively small amounts of information and ask a lot of questions to kind of get that information. And I think partly that sizing up happens even to us, who those of us who come back from America. There's an ability to kind of figure out, hey, this person's, you know, probably not from here and is probably going back someday. And a lot of people, when you see this in the dating market and you see it just in the friendship market, I think at first there were a lot of Indians who were a little bit skeptical because the ease with which you'd come suggested, you know, you might leave just as easily.
Anand Giridharadas is my guest. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. His new book is called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. We'll resume our conversation with Anand in just a moment and invite you to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We do want to take a break now for just a couple of minutes and ask you to please give us a call at 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org and make a contribution there. If you are ready to make a $120 contribution or more, you can choose to receive a copy of Anand Giridharadas' book, India Calling. Really a fascinating read, I think, for anyone who's interested in this new place that India is becoming. Certainly interesting for any first-generation Americans or people who can sort of identify with that cultural crossing that new Americans make and that their children make. Really a great piece of writing, a fascinating book, and just a great study of what India looks like today through both Indian eyes and also American eyes. We would love to hear from you at 1-888-694-6931 or online at kera.org. Your contribution makes conversations like this possible, makes it possible for us to, you know, bring into your radio, maybe into your car, people from all over the world, all different viewpoints. And we definitely think that is that service is worth paying for. Jeff Whittington, senior producer of Think, joins us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. It's great to be here today. What a great conversation. And we're thrilled that Anand could be with us today for the show. We hope that you're enjoying the conversation as well and that you'll make a contribution to the station online at kera.org or via the phone at 888-694-6931. You know, it is really the second week of the membership campaign, and this is one of those times of year where we'd really love to hear from you. We are over the halfway point, so our goal of $700,000 we have raised, thanks to many, many, many of you, just about $351,000. So we'd love to push that a little farther during the Think show today, and you can help out by going online to kera.org and making a contribution or by calling 888-694-6931.
You are KERA. Your dollars make this station possible, make it vibrant. Everything that you're listening to right now is the result of someone's contribution to this station. Now, some of those contributions come from grant writers and from major funders, but the vast majority, or not the vast majority, but the majority, come from people like you, people like me, frankly, people like Jeff, who listen to the station, who say, this has a value in my life, and I'm going to send a few dollars, say, every month to keep KERA strong. The place to go online to do this is kera.org, or you can choose to call 1-888-694-6931.
And if you choose to join the station today at the $120 membership level, we'll thank you with a copy of our guest's book, India Calling. It's fascinating, really sort of person-to-person kind of narrative about what things are like right now in India and the challenges that people face, because things are changing really rapidly in that country. And it's the kind of conversation that we're thrilled to be able to bring you on this show every single day. So please do your part right now. Please don't wait any longer. Go to kera.org and make a contribution or call 888-694-6931.
Again, you can receive a copy of India Calling with our compliments when you make a contribution of $120 or more. That's easy to do online at kera.org, or you can also do this via the phones at 1-888-694-6931. We'll be back in just a minute with Anand Giridharadas, and we appreciate your support. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're spending this hour with journalist Anand Giridharadas. He writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. His new book is called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. If you'd like to be part of this conversation, you can join us by phone at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Anand, welcome back.
Great to be here still.
Okay, so you were talking about the fact that, you know, people are constantly in India sort of sizing each other up. And most people, I think, are aware of the fact that caste, as an official determinant of whether you spend your life as a bricklayer or a priest or a professor, that doesn't really exist anymore. And yet people are still, it's sort of a theme throughout the book, trying to understand who they are and where they fall into the ranking. You tell a great story about returning a mattress to a friend that you'd borrow that really illustrates this. Can you talk about that?
It was, first of all, what you say is exactly right, that caste as a kind of very specific institution in its original form exists in some parts of India still and has mutated and changed form. But what remains of it, and that's what comes alive in the story that I'm about to tell you, is the idea behind caste, which is that humanity is in some ways fundamentally tiered, mm-hmm. that people come in kind of different levels of quality. And this story happened when my parents were visiting, and we went with them to a friend's house to have breakfast. And so we go to the house, and their servant was making breakfast, and he made this beautiful breakfast for us, and lovely coffee, and was kind of, you know, running around in all directions, doing what Indian servants do, which is very self-effacingly and generously served. And we left, and I realized, as soon as we got back to my home, that we had forgotten to bring this mattress that we borrowed from our friend. And so I changed into shorts and a t-shirt. It was quite hot outside, and ran back to the house carrying this mattress somewhat awkwardly, and brought it up the elevator and rang the doorbell. And the same servant, no one was home now except the servant, and the same servant looked through this peephole quite angrily at me and kind of barked, "What do you want?" And so then I said, "I'm here to deliver the mattress." And he kind of opened the door, and all of the deference that he'd showed before, you know, put his back flush against the wall, saying, calling me sir, etc., the first time when we had breakfast, vanished now. And he was kind of rude and aggressive. And I was a bit confused. "Put the mattress over there. Hurry up." And, you know, and we were just kind of screaming at him. And at some point, I just realized the guy didn't realize that the same person he had just served breakfast to had now come back to deliver a mattress, because many kind of privileged Indians wouldn't carry a mattress by themselves.
They would send their own servant to do the same thing.
As they say, they would send their man to do it. But in this case, I was my own man, to quote another writer on India. So he just didn't realize that. So I just kind of reminded him. I said, "Look, I was the guy who was here like 20 minutes ago. And I saw this physical conversion in his body that revealed such a deep truth about India. The guy kind of withered right before my eyes from this strong, kind of screaming, barking man, and his kind of his bearing shrunk, and his arms went in, and his chest kind of deflated. And he said, "Oh, right, so sorry, sir, so sorry, I'm so sorry." And the reason that moment was very important was, in a way, you never get to see both sides. In India, you're either above someone or below them. This is particularly old India that I'm speaking about. And the idea that you're just two people and that you don't have that position hadn't occurred to people like this man. And so I was first above him when I had that breakfast, and then I was below him when I was a mere mattress delivery man. And I think what is pushing into India now, the essence of the change, one wants to understand what is providing the kind of kinetic power behind India and perhaps to a degree China, is the conversion of largely feudal societies traditionally, in which people saw people in the way that that man saw me first time and the second time, into a society where people begin to have an assumption of equality. Not total equality, not radical equality, it's not happening overnight. But people are beginning to feel entitled, empowered, and worth something. and unworthy of that kind of treatment. And that's a very powerful revolution that has just got underway.
You know, I really appreciated the candor with which you wrote about the fact that, you know, you grew up middle class in the United States and without a house full of servants, as I think most of the people who are listening right now can identify with that. And when you first got there and you had some servants in your own home who would cook and clean for you, you at first really felt uncomfortable with this relationship. And then as time went on, you grew almost accustomed to it. And I think that's so interesting because it's so easy for us in the West to judge and say, well, how can these people think that another human being is somehow below them? And yet it's the way things seem to work, and it's sort of easy to fall into that.
I mean, it's interesting. For most of human history, most of us and our ancestors have lived in the way of the old India rather than the new India. This idea that we are all equal is a relatively new idea everywhere in the world, and is an idea that a lot of people have fought and died trying to defend. And America has had its own very long, difficult history trying to establish that idea.
Yeah.
And so you're exactly right. And when I... It was funny. It was partly when I was living there and had servants of my own, but it was also, you know, as a teenager, I remember reading about slavery and reading Uncle Tom's Cabin and these kinds of things in America. And I remember feeling, even in those days, a kind of special insight and access to the world that was being described there because of that connection I had to India. That, you know, today, if you live in America and you read Uncle Tom's Cabin, it's very hard to conjure that world based on anything around you. But if you know India and have spent time there and you've seen servants in India, that the world of Uncle Tom's Cabin, some of those relationships, the complexity of those relationships in which there's both admiration and contempt and degradation and love all mixed into these hierarchical relationships, is something that really came alive in India. And when I had servants of my own, it was really a test, and you see how you're tested. I started out very aggressive and, you know, very kind of polite and saying thank you every time anything was done for me. And over time, I think I slipped into the ways of the society. I started saying thank you less often. I started getting angry more easily. And I was not proud of that. But I think in a way, cultures are kind of contagious. And I absorbed a little bit of that. Even at the same time, though, as that culture is changing.
There's also this complexity in your observation that being Indian American in America is different from being Indian American in India. You're the same person, but it has to do with how people perceive them. And I love this story that you had been sort of a serious student in the United States and people sort of thought of you as a serious guy. But then suddenly in India you were, did you call yourself the fun master?
It was funny, you know, this, when I was, you know, like a lot of Indian Americans, I'm certainly not alone in this, and I wasn't even particularly gifted at math and science, so I wasn't necessarily the full extreme of this. But you're kind of, you know, Indian Americans are more famous for being, you know, nerds and hip hop stars,
right?
And so there was kind of that background. Then I arrived in India, and I was on this project in Ahmedabad, which is a city in the West that is prohibition dry, no alcohol. But like most laws in India, it is abundantly broken. And there are bootleggers all over Ahmedabad, as there were during prohibition in this country, and they get you what you need. And I was kind of the guy on our consulting team who liaised with the bootleggers. And it's funny because India, in a way, is considerably more repressed, at least traditionally. And again, that's something that's changing also. My relatively nerdy side became a kind of coolness there, and I was rather liberated by the standards of my colleagues.
Was that gratifying to you, or was it instantly apparent that it was all sort of situational?
I think it just makes you realize that there's no center, you know, that there's kind of, that you are what you are depending on the people around you, and you really have to work to whittle down to the few core things that you are, regardless of who you are. But, you know, things like coolness and confidence and even to some degree your values about whether you want to say thank you to a servant or not are so malleable. It's scary how malleable they are.
My guest is Anand Giridharadas. His new book is called India Calling. Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372 and speak with Ranish in Dallas. Hi, Ranish.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
Okay, I wanted to make a comment about the interplay between Indians who visit and the servants who I have. I'm Indian. I grew up here in Dallas, Texas my whole life, and I've spent about a year and a half of my life in India. The one misconception I find most common between people when they hear that there's servants in India that are very common is that the quality, it's not really like a Jeeves-type situation. It's just kind of a person who does services for you just as they would do for their own family. So you're eating the food they tend to cook for their own family, or you're getting the laundry service that they would do just for their own family. And I think it's important that you realize when you realize that, it kind of makes a very goodwill nature between the two. In all my times visiting India and having servants, they've become more of just like the family. And I've seen that happen with every one of my relatives there. They always have a servant that's in the family. And it's a very mutualistic relationship, and it's not one of subservience and command. My father, who passed away recently, one of his last wishes was that we always take care of one of the servants we have in our house who runs the house while we live here in Dallas, and we can only periodically visit in India. Now, that's what I wanted to say.
Well, I appreciate your call. I'm sorry to hear about your dad. Did you want to respond to that, Anand?
Yeah, I think that's a really, really interesting point. And I understand that there's an element of truth where I have a slightly different view. I think if you look at the history of servitude and slavery everywhere in the world, you will find both oppression and kind of terrible treatment and hierarchy, and you will also find all the things that the caller said. You will find love and a kind of this notion that servants are part of a family. It's very common in American slave narratives. And I think a lot of the way in which we think about servitude and slavery today is very black and white, where it's all oppression and hierarchy. And it's important to remember that it's this very weird mix of degrading people and convincing them and yourselves that they're part of your family. And there's certainly a lot of servants in India who are treated very well, who are not just treated as a transactional thing. But there's a dark side, in my view, to some of what the caller referred to, which is these are people often convinced to really sublimate themselves and their sense of themselves to you. So they're called family, and my family and other families, you know, refer to servants as family. But if they were really family, you would probably do a lot more to help them not be servants. You probably, and you know, there's people who teach them reading on the side and this and that. But if they're really family, the first thing you would do is probably get them out of service.
Anand Giridharadas is my guest. He's a journalist who writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. His new book is called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. We'll resume our conversation with Anand in a moment. We're going to do our best. We are aware that it's a little bit tough to hear. We're trying to work on that right now. So bear with us. It's going to be a continued, really interesting conversation. We appreciate your patience. While we are taking care of that, we want to take a couple of minutes to remind you that we are in our winter membership campaign. We call it membership. It is membership because you are KERA. KERA is possible because of you. It's also, to be very frank, a fundraising campaign because it is your dollars that allow us to provide you with this programming every day. We'd love to hear from you now at KERA.org online, or you can go on the phone to 1-888-694-6931. We've raised just shy of $351,000 so far in this fundraising campaign. That takes us about halfway there, which is wonderful, but we have the other half to go. And if you have not yet stepped forward to make a contribution in this drive, we would love to hear from you right now. If you're interested in making a contribution at or above the $120 level, we are pleased to be able to offer you copies of Anand Giridharadas' book. It's called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Really an interesting read, whether or not you have any personal connection to India. It's such an important country for us to understand now based on the way the world is changing and the way globalism is really shaping everything that we do, the ways that we work, the ways that we socialize and interact. Really a great read. Of course, you can pick it up anywhere, but if you also are ready to make your contribution to KERA right now, it's an ideal
combination of things. You can support the station at $120 or above and also receive a copy of the book. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hello, Chris Boyd. And we'll be able to continue our conversation, hopefully a little bit better sound with Anand Giridhar shortly here. Chris, you mentioned you can get your very own copy of his book, India Calling, when you join the station today at the $120 membership level. You can take care of that at kera.org. You can take care of that on the phone, 888-694-6931. I want to thank everyone who supported the station today and over the last week and a half or so during this membership campaign. It's really great to hear from you. We're a little over halfway toward our goal right now. So your contribution to the station today will help the drive in that much sooner. And you know what? It's Monday. It's a great day to take care of something that, quite frankly, you've probably been thinking about for some time. You've been considering joining the station. You've been considering doing your part. Well, this is a great day to do it. Please don't wait. Please do it right now.
I can't help but thinking about that song, Living on a Prayer, every time we say we're halfway there.
Oh, no.
So now I put that in everyone else's head.
Yeah, that's really evil.
Think about that while you dial 1-888-694-6931 or go online to kera.org. Halfway there is great. All the way there is even better because that allows us to move back into programming and quit fundraising for a matter of months, which we know you like. We like it, too. You know, we're not, as I've said the other day, we're not begging. If you're not giving us money, we're not begging from you. We're begging for you because we're asking someone else essentially to pay for the content that you're listening to. Most of you wouldn't allow that to happen in a restaurant or somewhere else that you do business. You do business with KERA by being a customer of the station, by being a listener to the station. We just ask you to please chip in some money to pay for the content that you consume.
Yeah, you get to decide what to give the station. We don't have a standard subscription fee. You can make the choice and how much the station's worth to you. Think about how much you listen. Think about what you've received from KERA. The news, the information, the conversations, the entertainment, and then make that call, 888-694-6931 or via the web at kera.org.
Anand Giridhar is our guest this hour. As you know, this amazing 29-year-old journalist writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. We do have copies of his new book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking, available today when you make a contribution at or above the $120 level. You can do this at kera.org. You can also do it on the phone at 1-888-694-6931. Pay with a credit or debit card, set up a sustaining membership, however you want to do it. We do appreciate your support.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Anand Giridhar. His new book is called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. When we talk about India remaking itself, it's interesting that you settled in the city that the British dubbed Bombay. Now it's often called Mumbai. You choose to call it Bombay. And can you talk for a minute about the Mumbai-Bombay question?
It's an interesting debate that continues to be had to this day. The original name, Bombay, seems to have come from the Portuguese, who referred to the city as Bombahia, which means beautiful bay in their language. And it really wasn't a city at that time. It was seven swampy islands. That they found and kind of gave it a unity through that name that it may have lacked as a settlement before that. And the name was changed in 1995 by a right-wing fundamentalist in some views party that took power of the government in Bombay and wanted to kind of purge the colonial legacy. And they went back to this name, Mumbai, but it's kind of unclear whether the history was that the city was actually called anything before it was called Bombahia. And so a lot of people generally have switched in some degree to Mumbai, but a lot of people call it what they called it before. People who spoke English often tend to call it Bombay. People who spoke Gujarati and Marathi, two local languages, often called it Mumbai and continue to do so, and people who spoke Hindi often called it Bombay. So that goes on too. So much like the city itself, which is very cosmopolitan and polychromatic, there continue to be many names for that city on the sea.
You also found it to be much more cosmopolitan with regard to the liberation with which young people decide to date and go out, which was different from what you had remembered as a kid.
It, as I said earlier, it always struck me as a very repressed place as a child, and no one was dating, and you know, people kind of went far into their teenage years before they were allowed to shave their faces or shave their legs. And it felt very desexualized, and love and marriage seemed kind of very desexualized. People kind of going through the motions, performing their functions, but no one kissing on the street, for example, things like that. And when I moved there in 2003, one of the things that really struck me over the next 6 years was the extent to which that had changed, and there was now a lot of romantic love in India, and a lot of people not just kissing on the streets, but more kind of significantly choosing love over family pragmatism as the kind of reason for marrying. But in the traditional Indian pattern of modernizing, a lot of this change is kind of folded into the past rather than simply breaking from the past. So you have young people who kind of drink and smoke and maybe do cocaine and hook up in the Western way, who may simultaneously be surfing online with their parents for a suitable spouse while tolerating their grandparents using old family networks to find an arranged partner and kind of feeling that all these methods are simultaneously okay.
Now, your parents were somewhat iconoclastic. They married in the 70s and chose each other as partners. Were they the only ones in their families to do this?
No, they weren't the only ones. I think the 70s was the time when this was, you know, this was start. And look, there have been love marriages even before that. But you know, over the course of the last 30, 40 years is when you really start to see this idea push in to the society. And in a way, what made it work at that point was that the nature and understanding of clan is changing. You know, my mother thought that actually her parents wouldn't support the marriage because they weren't from the same part of India. But they actually, you know, the new way of defining clan was education. They both came from very educated families. And as it turns out, my grandfather, my mother's father, was you know, fine as long as it was someone well-educated like himself. And that's the, you know, the slow way, one family at a time, that this process of change is happening.
You know, another thing I think for many people in the West who have not grown up in the tradition of arranged marriages, it seems awful and sort of cruel, but you have a really charming story in here about your paternal grandparents' arranged marriage. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I think you're exactly right to say that, you know, spending time in India complicated a lot of my simple visions about what was good and what was not good. And one of those visions was about, you know, arranged marriage being kind of primitive. And one of the things I realized that I would, you know, never prefer to have one of them myself was through encountering a diary that my paternal grandmother had kept about her first year of arranged marriage. And the thing that was very striking to me was she very much considered herself a kind of spectator to events. And that's something that in the modern world we don't like to be. We like to be kind of front and center of our own lives. But she also seemed very free of blame and pain and soul-searching that young people in the West know all too well, and that Indians, young Indians, are starting to deal with as they confront this new world of choice available to them. And you realize, I realize in reading that diary, that there's something, I guess, liberating in a very different way. Have certain things in your life made up for you.
What sort of insight did you gain into, in particular, your parents' ideas about money during the time that you've been living in India?
You know, the idea of money that you find in India today is very much in flux. And I had grown up in America with an experience that probably many other Indian Americans share, which is that our parents came from a world in which money was something very different than what it was in America. Consumption was kind of to be frowned on a little bit, you know, necessary evil. but one wasn't supposed to think of, you know, what things to buy every moment. Television was not to be watched that much. Money was to be saved, be kind of careful. And that was very much a reflection of the world in India that they grew up in, which was the 1670s, a world of scarcity, a socialist place where the flaunting of money was not culturally rewarded, and there wasn't much money to flaunt. By the time I moved back to India, it had become a veritable circus of money. Mm-hmm. Money was everywhere. Money was essential to how people thought. And 2/3 of the country has barely come into any more money than they had before. But even there in the villages in India, people now talk and think in a way that is very much shaped by the idea of money. They're future-oriented, they're accumulation-oriented, and they want to keep up with their peers. And so I've very much got a chance to see one vision of money, the vision that I associated with the India that my parents left, yield to another vision of money in the India that I found.
I mean, I guess in part that has to be a factor of the reality that now people in India can imagine that it's possible that they might have more wealth than their parents had before them. Do you think that your parents would have left if they'd been born the year that you were and had grown up in what essentially is today's India?
A great question. I mean, I've thought about that a lot, and I don't know the answer. I think certainly what I would say is they wouldn't have needed to leave. Mm-hmm. The thing that my father felt, he wouldn't have felt in today's India. If he had been a young manager at the same company, I don't think he would have felt that it was a crazy impossibility. Now, who knows if there were other factors that may have driven him away. But at least if you look at the reasons that they did go at that time, and particularly he felt compelled to go because of a lack of professional opportunity, that premise of their departure has been pulled out from beneath all of our feet.
Anand, it's been a really interesting conversation. The book is such a nuanced look at what India is today and what it's becoming. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
It's been a delightful conversation.
Anand Giridharadas is a journalist who writes the Currents column for the International Herald Tribune and the New York Times Online. His new book is called India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. You can be part of the group of North Texans and of listeners all over the world on the podcast and online that make this station possible by contacting us now online at kera.org and making a contribution of financial support, or by calling 1-888-694-6931. Hello, Jeff Whittington.
Hey, Chris Boyd, and hello to you. We would love to see your contribution come across this hour in response to our conversation with Anand Giridharadas. And the book India Calling. Of course, you can get your very own copy of the book when you join the station today at the $120 membership level. That's just $10 a month when you become a sustaining member of the station. And you know how important sustenance is. We all need it every day to survive, and businesses need it. And you know what? Even public radio stations need it in the form of your contribution dollars. Without your contributions, this station would only be able to do about 42% of the work. And that would be that'd be a real tragedy. We would only be able to bring you 42% of the shows. We'd only be able to bring, so we could choose to, you know, to go up to about 26 minutes each hour, and then just
dead play, air.
Then have dead air for the remaining half of the hour, or we could just do 42% of the day, and then just have dead air the rest of the time, or maybe we just do the year, and we could all. Well, there'd only be 42% of us here. So the 42% of us that would be working here still on your behalf, maybe we could just take off 6 months or 7 months of the year. Of course, we wouldn't be able to actually make a living doing. See, you see where this is going. Without your contribution, this place wouldn't exist. And that's why we ask you, and we continue to ask you, and we've continued to ask you to do your part, because it's absolutely necessary. And if everyone who just was going to contribute would go ahead and do it, we could wrap up the drive that much sooner. So it's a great thing to participate. It's a great thing that you listen, but it's an even greater and more important thing that you participate by becoming a member.
Jeff and I talk about this. We both love the station and feel good about its prospects, but Jeff sometimes will see things from the more pessimistic perspective, and I will see it from the more optimistic perspective. The inverse of him saying, you know, without you we wouldn't exist, is that because of you we do exist. The truth is you should be proud of yourself. All of you who are members of the station and who are making that choice today to become supporting members of the station, make it possible. If you love public radio, if you know, every time somebody says, gosh, I love public radio, you can think to yourself, well, you can thank me because I have made this contribution with my dollars. Now, your contribution might be $30, it might be $3,000, it might be any amount in between or more or less. The point is that your support keeps this station strong and honestly contributes to the vitality of public radio nationwide. 1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number, or you can go online to KERA.org and make your contribution there.
Yeah, we hope you'll consider doing it online if you have access to the internet, or maybe you're even listening online, because it does save the station a few dollars when you make your contribution online. We'll pay for the phone call, of course, the toll-free number 888-694-6931. But if you can do it online, that's great because it's really quick and efficient for the station. If you use your credit card, your dollars go to work right away. So think about making that online credit card contribution today and help us wrap up the drive that much faster. We won't be waiting to hear from you anymore, and we would love to be able to thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. David Boothman in Dallas and Tom Greico in Carrollton, for your contributions. Thanks also to David Fadley in Plano, Jacob Fry in Denton, and Linda Ponder in Colleyville. Thanks to everyone who has been calling and going online to KERA.org and calling 1-888-694-6931. Again, we do have copies of Anand Giridharadas' book, India Calling, An Intimate Portrait of a Nation's Remaking. We've set those at the $120 contribution level and above. Your contribution in any amount really does matter. You know, you mentioned, Jeff, that when you pay with a credit or a debit card, your contribution goes to work right away. If you're doing this right now, maybe you can think, all right, you know what? North Texas, America, the next hour of Think is on me. Think about that.
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
How much is that?
I don't want to break it down because Ted Hilberg does not allow us to mess with the money around here, which is a very good thing for all of us involved. But yeah, you know, maybe whatever it is, maybe it's 20 minutes, maybe it's 3 days. I don't know. Whatever your contribution is,
sure.
You are giving that not only making sure that it's there for you, but also sort of giving it as a gift to your neighbors in North Texas.
Yeah, people, even people you might be surprised, actually, who all listens to public radio. And some of those folks, you probably want them to listen. And when you make your contribution, you know, they're listening because you made your contribution. And maybe they'll be inspired to join you and to do their part as well because you contributed, because we were able to ask them, because you made the station possible. So please don't wait. Please go to KERA.org, make your contribution right now, or do it on the phone at 888-694-6931.
Thank you, Chuck and Patsy Haynes in Arlington, for your contribution. We are now at almost $352,000, $351,800 raised thus far in this campaign. That is thanks to you and to your friends and to your neighbors. Make sure that you feel free to boast a little bit about this once you make your contribution to the people you know, maybe in social media, because your contribution, you'd be surprised how often someone you know will see that and be influenced to also do the right thing. You matter. Your friends care what you think. They care what you do. And your contribution may very well inspire someone else to do exactly the same thing.
Yeah, tell your friends and family and tell your neighbors that you supported the station. You know, when you talk about what you heard on KERA, when someone at work says, you know, I heard this NPR story the other day, you can say, oh, I supported the station during the drive. Have you done it? Because it's really important. Trust me, your advocacy out there really does go a long way. And quite frankly, we can use the help to get this drive wrapped up. If you could, you know, become a pitch person as well.
This is your source for NPR News, 90.1 KERA, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, 100.1 K261 CW, Tyler, 88.3 K202 DR, Wichita Falls, 99.3 K257 EV, Sherman.
And no matter where you listen, of course, it's KERA. It's your North Texas Public Radio News and Information Service. You don't find this kind of programming, you don't find a show like this anywhere else in this market, the fifth market for radio in the country. So why not support it? You know, and if it's one of those deals where you just can't do it right now, well, you know what? That's fine. because we totally understand. Everybody has times like that. But if you can make a contribution to the station, if you can send a few dollars KERA's way, it really does make a difference.
And consider that you, you know, if you want to make a substantial contribution, you might set up a sustaining membership, which breaks it up so that if you said, you know, every year I like to give $60, a sustaining membership just takes $5 a month out of your checking account, makes it really easy to afford this contribution. A lot of people make much larger contributions with the sustaining membership. It's $125 a month. That amount actually qualifies you to be a Friends member of KERA at the $1,500 level, which comes with a lot of special perks as well. So whatever level works in your budget, we would encourage you, please, to get in touch with us now and make your contribution. Please go online to kera.org or call 1-888-694-6931. Thanks.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.